are listening to the most original talk radio station anywhere. We are LA Talk Radio at latalkradio.com. You're listening to The Legal Help Desk with Salar Atrazadeh, only on LA Talk Radio.
Hello, and welcome to The Legal Help Desk. On this program, as usual, we'll discuss legal principles, recent cases, and updates. Today, my guest is Bob Zeidman, and we will discuss software forensics and related issues. Mr. Zeidman is one of the leading experts on intellectual property, which includes patents, trademarks, and copyrights, particularly as it relates to software. He is the president and founder of Zeidman Consulting, a premier contract research and development firm in Silicon Valley that focuses on consulting to law firms about intellectual property disputes. His clients have included Apple Computer, Cisco Systems, Facebook, Intel, Symantec, Texas Instruments, and Zynga. Bob is also the president and founder of Software Analysis and Forensic Engineering Corporation, which is a leading provider of software intellectual property analysis tools for use in forensic examinations. In fact, Bob is considered a pioneer in the field of analyzing and synthesizing software source code. He's also worked and testified in over 125 cases involving billions of dollars in disputed intellectual property. He's a prolific writer and instructor, giving seminars at conferences around the world. Among his publications are numerous articles on engineering and business, as well as 5 textbooks, 3 novels, and 3 screenplays. His book, The Software Detective's Handbook, is the first comprehensive text on quantitative software forensics. Bob holds numerous patents and earned his 2 bachelor degrees in physics and electric engineering from Cornell University and a master's degree in electrical engineering from Stanford University. Please bear in mind that my discussions are for general purposes only and aren't intended to create an attorney-client relationship. The law is complicated, and you should consult with a qualified attorney before taking legal action. Also, please make sure you don't disclose confidential information during the program. For more information, visit latalkradio.com. You can also call me on the air at 818-602-4929. To ask questions during the program. Again, our guest speaker today is Bob Zeidman, and I think I have him on the air. How are you today, Bob?
Hi, Salar. I'm doing well. Thanks a lot for having me on your show.
Not at all. It's a pleasure of mine, and we've spoken in the past about basically your company and your activities, and I was thoroughly impressed with the amount of knowledge you have in this area, so I'm really glad that we've had the opportunity to invite you and have our audience listen to your information, your knowledge that you're going to hopefully disperse today.
Okay, thank you. I'm looking forward to it.
My pleasure. So I think it's best to start off with a little bit about your background. I kind of gave the audience a brief synopsis of your expertise, but I think it's best for us to hear more about your background and what you do, how you came into this industry, and what's been accomplished so far. And finally, what are the challenges that you are continuing to encounter in the technology world?
Sure. Well, let me start with, I have a unique perspective, I think, because I started a number of small businesses and I'm an individual inventor with a number of patents. And, I basically got into litigation support kind of by accident. I was trying to raise funds for a startup company, and I went to a professor of mine, actually a professor at Stanford that I knew, and said, would you like to invest? And he said, not really, but he was working as an expert witness on a case involving trade secrets, and he needed some assistance. And when he told me how much it paid, I said, I'm in.
That's usually a catalyst.
Yeah, and over the years I started doing short jobs, consulting, well, sometimes as much as a year. But then I would use the funds to start a company. And, you know, I started a number of small companies. And eventually what happened was I was working on one company, putting in some money into a company, and it wasn't, it had a great technology, but it wasn't succeeding. And so I needed to raise more funds, so I started doing a, you know, an attorney came to me, a patent attorney, but he was involved in a litigation involving software copyright infringement or trade secret theft.
Right.
And he said, well, the job is to compare these two programs and find out if any if there's any matching, if there's any copying between the code.
Right.
And so people in my position really, you know, generally like this kind of thing because you get paid per hour and you can spend hundreds of hours if the client has the budget just going line by line and trying to look for similarities. And, you know, even though it cut down my hours, I started writing some little utility programs to help automate the process. And what happened was it sped things up, and I started telling other experts and other lawyers. The experts were interested in it. A lot of people gave me great feedback. The lawyers were interested because they didn't care how I did it, but they knew I worked really efficiently because I used this software tool I had.
Right.
And eventually the software tool, you know, I turned it into a full-fledged program, and I started a company to sell it. And as I mentioned, I had this other startup where I was putting a lot of money in. And I had this little program I wrote in my spare time that was generating income because lawyers were willing to pay for it. It took me about a year, though. I think if I were a better entrepreneur, maybe I would have realized a lot sooner to kill the business that's losing money and focus on the business that's making money.
Well,
but that's how I got into comparing software. You know, and along the way, I've also been doing patent cases. But really, the software comparison tools were the things that made me stand out, and I started selling the tools and hiring more consultants. And the software business is a small, steady business. The consulting business has been growing slowly. And I feel that I'm, you know, I realized that people weren't doing these kind of comparisons, or if they were, there was no standard for it. And so we'd get to court, and people would have their own ways of doing things. And it depended on what the jury liked or who the jury liked. So I decided to try to standardize everything. So I, you know, published papers on how my tools worked and procedures for using them. And now I train people on how to do that. And the idea is, I'm sure you've run into this, that there's opinions are all over the place. But if I can standardize it, come up with ways of standardizing what the opinion should be for comparing software or analyzing software, then I think the trials will go faster and be more fair.
Absolutely, and I think we talked about this extensively when you visited my office in L.A. One thing for the audience to keep in mind is that what Bob is talking about is, obviously he mentioned trade secrets, and trade secrets are information including a formula, a pattern, let's say a program, a device, a method or a technique that derives independent economic value, and it's generally not known to the public, so it needs to be kept secret or private. And if it loses that status by basically going from private or confidential information over to public knowledge, then it becomes public knowledge and it loses its status as a trade secret. Am I correct, Bob?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I've been advising startup companies about these things. You know, a lot of young entrepreneurs don't understand the value of intellectual property until they've lost it.
Right.
And with trade secrets, you know, personally, I tell companies, look, you know, have people sign non-disclosure agreements and mark, you know, sometimes investors won't do that, but mark everything confidential.
Right.
I've seen cases lost because trade secrets were not marked confidential, and you know, a founder of a startup showed some paperwork or showed some code to a friend, and if somebody ends up taking that and can show that, well, you were showing it to friends and you were showing it to your family, and you weren't marking it confidential, then it really was, you weren't trying to keep it secret. Mm-hmm. And therefore, you can lose it as a trade secret, because a trade secret has to be something that you're protecting.
Right.
So there's things like that where a lot of entrepreneurs, I think, they get kind of sloppy.
Right.
You know, you don't want to go overboard, but, you know, marking things confidential, trying to get NDAs from everyone you can. Mm-hmm. Even, I tell people, even if you're doing business with your best friend or your mother, you know, mark it confidential. Ask them for an NDA. They shouldn't have a problem signing it. So you've got a paper trail that you really were, you really felt this was valuable and you were trying to protect it.
Exactly, exactly. And, you know, note to self, just make sure that you keep it confidential. And if you have to disclose it, make sure you have an NDA, which is a non-disclosure agreement that my law firm drafts all the time. And it's a couple pages. And you have the other person sign it, saying that they're going to use it for a specific purpose. They're not going to disclose it. And if they do disclose it, they're going to make sure that that other person that knows about it also basically takes the protective measures to keep it confidential. And that's the norm that we see. And when I have clients come in, whether they're startups, entrepreneurs, or established businesses with intellectual property, that's the general protocol. And without that, you're not taking the first level of protection, which is a risk.
You know, and I'll add to that that, you know, I also suggest that entrepreneurs work with an attorney like you that that has expertise in this area. Because sometimes they say, well, we don't want to spend money on an attorney, but I've seen lots of times where the wording wasn't quite right. In fact, I've gotten, as sophisticated as I believe I am, there were times when I was younger where I wrote my own agreements, and some wording wasn't quite right and got misinterpreted and had pretty serious consequences. So a lawyer like you, who's trained in this information, you know, in this area of law, can really be a big asset in at least reviewing the terms and making sure that everything looks okay.
That's right. That's right. And I have nothing against, you know, people that want to do it themselves, but at least have it reviewed by a professional who specializes in this area. That's generally my my suggestion. Folks, we have Mr. Zeidman on the line. He's our guest today. He's one of the leading experts on intellectual property, particularly as it relates to software. He's the founder and president of Zeidman Consulting. The website is ZeidmanConsulting.com. And it's a premier contract research and development firm in Silicon Valley. He also is the president and founder of Software Analysis and Forensic Engineering Corporation. The website is www.safe-corp.biz. That's B-I-Z. And again, I think it's really good that we're talking about these topics, because I get these calls all the time, and I hold seminars and also events in my office or other places where we talk about cybersecurity. How can you protect your trade secrets in cyberspace? Because it's easily taken. People can walk into the office and, let's say, connect their USB or flash drive and, you know, take the information that they need, walk out of your office, out of your company, and disclose that information, which causes it to lose its private or confidential status.
Yeah, and there's a lot of that going on. It's, you know, we get involved after somebody's discovered that their information has been stolen.
Right.
And unfortunately, I'm sure there's a lot more cases of intellectual property being stolen than we know about, because the ones that aren't discovered, at least we never find out about.
That's right. And I actually wrote a blog in October of this year. It's entitled Protecting Trade Secrets in Cyberspace. By the way, the blog's URL is internetlawyerblog.com. And in there, we talked about how essential a business's trade secrets is to its foundation growth and development. I basically defined what a trade secret is. You can find the definition on the USPTO's website also. But how can someone protect their trade secrets? What are, you know, the protocols? How can you prevent it? Because once it's out there, Once someone's someone comes into the office, like I said, or hacks into the network, basically takes the code or the metadata, which is data about data, and you detect it somehow, and then hire an attorney or a forensic computer person to figure out basically what's been going on, where the breach is, who took it, where they took it, how they took it, all these fact-finding procedures, then how do you prevent it? I think that's the first level of protection, or the first question in my mind, at least. Correct?
Yeah, and you know, that gets into an area that's pretty sophisticated. You know, from our point of view, I recommend the things I talked about, you know, taking precautions, you know, at least marking things as confidential, putting copyright notices, and we can talk a little bit about copyright if you want, sure, into your software. So at least if it does get stolen, you can prove that it was stolen. But keeping it from getting stolen is a really difficult problem. It's not, you know, it overlaps with my area of expertise. I know some people who are involved, a lot of people who are very involved in the field.
Right.
But it seems like most of that ends up coming down to human error. No matter how good your network is protected, from a technical point of view, you know, the problems that we see are, what do you do to protect against the people who work for you? The cases we get involved with are almost all of them, if not all of them, are people who were employed by you to write code, and then they take it and sell it to a competitor or start their own company.
Exactly. And one level of protection are the non-compete clauses or agreements. In California, they're strictly construed because California is a more liberal state. It wants basically free mobility between, you know, one job to the next. It doesn't want to stop or prevent someone from moving to you know, another company or getting hired by another competitor even. But you could, under certain circumstances, have a non-compete agreement to protect the company's secrets, number one. The other way to do these, you know, preventative measures or engage in them is to provide computers that do not have hard drives. Basically have some kind of monitoring or auditing system where you can keep track of the activities or transactions on the network. Those are some of the just basic preventative measures that I can think of.
You know, also one thing that I've seen, you know, we work for both plaintiffs and defendants.
Right.
And I've also seen cases where trade secret theft was used kind of as a hammer by a big company to stop a small competitor.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that, you know, the solution is typically to document what you're doing. And don't do anything foolish. I see entrepreneurs, you know, I've been involved with entrepreneurs who have said, oh, we're going to start a company, but first we're going to continue working at our current company and do this project on the side, which can be okay. But a lot of times it's related to what they're doing at their job.
And
I tell them, you know, you've got to make people aware at your company that you're doing this. And if they say, well, I don't want to,
right,
digging and say, why? Is it competitive? And they say, well, it's not really competitive, but somebody might think it's competitive. You know, and then you're leaving yourself open. If you leave your company and are successful, you're going to get sued.
That's correct.
You know, take these things into account. You know, sometimes you have to quit your company to start a new one, or sometimes you have to go to your boss and say, here's what I'm doing.
Or at least do what you're doing using your own computer tools, devices, applications, because once you're at work, and I'm not a labor or employment lawyer, I specialize in business and internet, but when you use your employer's devices, tools, applications, resources, for lack of better terms, then that work product, whatever it is, it could be an image, it could be a program code, anything that is worth, you know, something of value, the employer can say, you used the company's resources, and it belongs to us, not you.
Mm-hmm. Right. Actually, I've seen a number of copyright infringement and trade secret, software copyright and trade secret misappropriation cases,
mm-hmm,
where somebody was found having taken code from his employer. And his argument was that, well, I had this code before I was employed. I just brought it into work.
Right.
And that doesn't hold up. The fact is that from what I've seen, the law said, and it probably varies from state to state, but in the cases I've worked on, the court said, well, you know, your employment agreement says if you're using it at work, it belongs to the company. If you brought it in from home, you are implicitly giving it to the company.
That's,
so, but I can also tell you in all those cases where that's been used, that was really a fake excuse. You know, we basically caught somebody copying code, and then they tried to say, well, this was my code, but they could never prove that it was their code in the first place anyway.
That's right. That's right. It's complicated. And again, for the audience, for the listeners today, just please bear in mind that our discussions are for general purposes only. And if you have any questions or concerns, do contact a qualified attorney who can help you with basically assessing your case and evaluating your claims.
You know, I definitely agree with that. And one thing I see these days is sometimes a someone who's involved in a case will contact me directly. Mm-hmm. And it puts me in a very difficult situation. I try to just talk in generalities.
Right.
I tell them not to tell me anything confidential. Mm-hmm. And to find an attorney first. Because, you know, they may tell me something that is not good for their case. Or it may appear that I'm biased because I started talking with the person accused of stealing code or the person who, you know, one of the parties in the litigation.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't want the expert to even have an appearance of bias.
No, not at all. And there's something called the attorney-client privilege. And once you hire an attorney as a client, you have certain rights and privileges, which includes the confidentiality of your communications, whether it's with an attorney or with an expert that the attorney hires for you to speak to. So it all falls under the umbrella or the category of attorney-client privilege.
Right, right.
And I think it's important to talk about software forensics because it's still a new and developing area. You've been around it for years. So I think it would be beneficial for the audience to hear from your basically perspective, what is software forensics and how is it used or what is it used for?
So that's a good question. And sometimes people confuse it with digital, what's called digital forensics or computer forensics.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really recovering things off a disk drive or things off a computer, maybe deleted files or you know, corrupted files, imaging disks and finding out what was on someone's computer or in memory or what they were doing on the internet. But that's not software forensics. What I do is software forensics, which involves looking at the code for different programs, usually the source code, which is the human-readable code, the things that say, if A is equal to 5, print out this message. If A is greater than 10, print out this other message.
Mm-hmm.
But also looking at the ones and zeros that the computer runs, executes, to run your programs, whether it's Word or your internet browser or your operating system. And that didn't receive a lot of attention outside of academia until I started doing this work roughly 10 years ago. And in academia, they had a different goal. They had a goal to publish complicated papers with complicated algorithms. And, well, my goal was come up with something simple, but something that would be solid and hold up in court.
Okay.
And that's what I did. And one of the things that my tools and my process takes into account that other tools don't. In academia, you know, they want to find the ultimate solution,
right,
which is, you know, if you're searching for the answer to a problem, whatever that problem is, you want to come up with a solution.
At least
and in academia, if you're comparing two different programs, you want to find out copied or not copied.
Right.
But in real life, it's more complicated than this, and that was one problem that those tools had in court. Because there were reasons that programs can look similar and not have been copied from each other.
Right.
So I came up, you know, I did an exhaustive search of the literature and my experience. I talked to a number of other experts in the field and lawyers, and we realized that there's six reasons why programs can appear similar. The biggest one is third-party code. A lot of programmers go out and get open source code, which is free to use.
Right.
And if two programs use the same open source code, they'll, you know, it'll come up that they match, but they weren't copied. They just both use the same legally obtained code.
Right. And an example of an open source code is like Unix, Linux.
Exactly.
Things like that.
And there's a lot of that out there. And so there's a number of other things. You know, I won't go into detail, but you've got tools for generating programs so they look similar even though they're not copied.
Right.
There's things that people are taught in school that, you know, maybe a lot of people use, but again, it's not copied. You know, you mentioned that California labor laws are pretty liberal. And that's true, and especially in California, but as I understand in all the states, I believe, you know, a programmer can write a program to do one thing at one company and go to another company and do the same kind of thing as long as he's not taking trade secrets or actual code with him.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, just like if you're to write an article on a copyright infringement and you were to do another one on patent infringement, your style would show, and there'd be similarities in the article.
Sure.
And so the same person writing two programs independently will look the same, even though nothing was copied. So we've got a process to go through and eliminate all these factors. And when we go through a process and we find anything that was copied, it's pretty much a slam dunk that we've gone through such a rigorous process that that nobody successfully challenged it. On the other hand, if you're a defendant being accused of copying code, and we go through our process and find nothing remaining, then you know, you're pretty much cleared of that charge. Nobody's successfully challenged that in court.
Wow, that's quite a success track.
In fact, I'll tell you just briefly that I don't know if you're probably familiar with the famous Facebook case.
I am, yes, I am.
Yeah, and it's, you know, made into a movie called The Social Network.
Mm-hmm.
And I like to tell people I'm in that movie because the actor playing Mark Zuckerberg holds up some sheets at a deposition, turning to those two Winklevoss twins at Harvard.
Right.
And he turns to them and he holds up these papers and he said, "I didn't copy your code," something like that.
I remember.
And I tell people, that's me. That was my report he was holding up. Because I did actually work on that Facebook case.
Yeah, I remember you telling me. That's quite impressive. That's very impressive.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun. That was really what put me on the map. My tools were used, and unfortunately I couldn't talk about the case for years. now a couple years ago, I was given the okay to mention, you know, no details, but just to say that I worked on it.
Right. Right, so what should someone do if they suspect that their software code has been stolen? What's the protocol? What's the procedure?
Well, you know, first of all, contact an attorney.
Okay.
An attorney who's experienced with, you know, intellectual property issues. And document everything that you've done. Document the reasons why you think it's stolen. And if you haven't registered a copyright for your software, go and register it. It's extremely simple. You can upload code files on the web, and you pay, I think it's $35 to get a copyright registration.
Right, right.
Now, some people are nervous about copywriting their code because the idea of copyright was to make it public,
mm-hmm.
to give you protection in return for making it public, and you have, in addition to your copyright issues, you have trade secrets. You're secreting algorithms that produce, you know, what you do faster and better than anyone else. But software copyright is unusual in that it allows you to redact a whole bunch of code,
mm-hmm.
and not even submit much of your code. You only have to submit a sample, and you can redact anything that is a trade secret, which makes it kind of odd. But I've been in cases where we've gone to the copyright office and requested the code that was submitted for a copyright, and there's almost nothing. It's almost, you know, something like 50 blank pages with mm-hmm. a few words here and there because everything else has been redacted.
Right. And for the audience out there, there's a difference between copywriting anything, including software or a website, than patenting it. When you patent something, you're protecting an invention, let's say an algorithm that's being used for that specific program, could potentially be patented. And you would need to speak with a patent lawyer about the chances of success, because you might submit an application to the patent office and it may be rejected for whatever reason. But generally, copywriting protects works of authorship, such as writings, music, and things like that. You can go to the USPTO's office website, which is uspto.gov, for more information about patents and trademarks. You can also go to the United States Copyright Office, which is copyright.gov, for more information about copyrights. Please continue.
Yeah, and one thing that's not always understood about copyright is that that some entrepreneurs don't know is that in order to proceed with a lawsuit, you have to register a copyright on your software.
Right.
But you can register the copyright right before you file your papers for the litigation. Mm-hmm. But that's not recommended. The best thing to do is file your copyright as soon as you release your software, so that actually gives you more protection if somebody does copy it. If you only register the copyright after you believe someone's stolen it, mm-hmm. you don't get as much protection.
Right.
And in fact, I've actually been on cases, at least one case, where someone stole some code and realized that the original owner had never registered the copyright.
Oh boy.
And so the thief registered the copyright. And now you've got a difficult situation because the government, which doesn't do any checking when you register your copyright, it just keeps a record of it.
Right.
But it appears that the thief owns the copyright, you know, because that's what the government records say.
At least on record, right.
Yeah. So my advice to entrepreneurs is register the copyright as soon as you can. And then you mentioned patents. You know, there's a lot of interest these days in patents. And I have a lot of stories about patents, but I tell people, you know, a lot of entrepreneurs getting out of school will tell me, well, you know, my professors tell me patents aren't valuable anymore. Well, I was told that about 25 years ago when I came up with a software invention, mm-hmm. and a Stanford Business School professor said patents aren't useful anymore, so I abandoned my patent, mm-hmm. and you know, what I had invented, my company failed, but the industry turned into a multi-billion-dollar industry, and somebody else got a patent and is collecting license fees from all these companies and doing extremely well.
Okay.
And so I tell entrepreneurs, even if you don't believe in software patents or don't believe in patents, your competitors probably do.
Right.
So I suggest, you know, sitting down with a patent agent or a patent attorney. I often advise companies about patents and pick, you know, one or two or three, depending on your budget, of your best inventions. Mm-hmm. You know, the algorithms that were the most difficult to come up with or that give you the biggest advantage, and file patents on them.
I think it's important too. I think people need to protect their ideas, their inventions, if possible. And again, with all the apps and applications, the iPhone apps, the smartphone apps that have been distributed and organized by different entities, the patent office is more reluctant to basically reject and analyze the specific software, because they're so similar that it makes it difficult to distinguish which is which or which is different. Do you have any thoughts about that?
Yeah, I do. You know, I think that there's been a lot of talk, and this is almost maybe another discussion sometime, but there's been a lot of talk about reforming patents, and there have been some bills going through Congress to reform the patent system. Mm-hmm. I personally believe that the reforms are hurting small businesses and individual inventors. Mm-hmm. They're being promoted by the big companies, Microsoft, Google. There's a bunch of organizations and universities that are against patent reforms. And I think the biggest problem with the patent office is definitely a problem, but it's the inefficiency of the office, the fact that it takes very long to examine patents, that the examiners don't do a good job of finding prior art, which is previously published documents that show the invention, which means you shouldn't be able to get a patent on it.
Right.
So I think what happens is what comes out of the patent office is you get a bunch of patents that shouldn't have been issued, but you also get patents that should be issued that just languish in the patent process for too long. And all of these, there's ways of improving it. A number of people have ideas, but I don't like the way the patent system is being changed. To me, it's almost like saying, we don't have the right medicines to treat the patient, so let's, change the number of doctors or the number of patients, whereas we should be changing the medicines instead.
I understand your point, and that's a very valid point. Folks, we have Bob Zeidman on the air with us. He's one of the leading experts on intellectual property, particularly as it relates to software. His clients have included Apple Computer, Cisco Systems, Facebook, Intel, Symantec, Texas Instruments, and Zynga. He has two companies. He's the president and founder of both. The first one is Zeidman Consulting. The website is ZeidmanConsulting.com. And the other one is www.safe-corp.biz. It's called the Software Analysis and Forensic Engineering Corporation. Bob, you mentioned something about, we talked about actually how do you suspect that your software code has been stolen, or what do you do to avoid being accused of stealing software? What are the procedures? What are the steps to take once you think or you suspect that your software code has been stolen?
Well, you should definitely talk to an attorney who's got experience.
Right.
And then find an expert. Usually the attorney finds the expert, but sometimes the client, the people involved, the companies involved, will directly find an expert.
Right.
And, I'd recommend that you talk to the experts and find out what their experience is, what tools they're using. One issue is that I mentioned there are people who, there's a whole field of digital forensics, which is really recovering data from disks. And those people are very good. And I don't, my company doesn't try to duplicate what they do. Mm-hmm. If somebody says we need to get something off a disk, then they, we recommend someone who has the expertise in that field.
Right.
And unfortunately, some of those people will say, oh, we can do software forensics too. But you've really got to, quiz them about what's their experience, what do they know about software, what kind of tools do they use to do their comparisons and their analysis. Because, it's two different fields. It's like, again, for the example of a doctor, you wouldn't go to a foot doctor to take out your appendix, even if the doctor says he's really good with a scalpel. So you want to find the person with the right expertise. Now, also, one thing that's unique about our software, our tool is called CodeSweep. The tool is called a combination of different tools. Mm-hmm. In CodeSweep, when you go to court and you convince the judge, convince the court that you've got a reasonable that there's a reasonable suspicion that code's been copied, then you'll go through a process where the lawyers will agree on discovery, where each side is supposed to turn over its code. Of course, there's problems there too, but
of course,
that's a separate issue. Assuming both sides have turned over their code, you would run a tool like CodeMatch, which compares the code.
Right.
And then you'd run these are all part of our CodeSweep tools. And then something like Source Detective, which searches online. So let's say you've got code that looks pretty similar, but maybe it's open source code like Linux. Well, our tool will search online and it'll search Linux. If it finds it in Linux, it says, okay, this is not an issue.
Right.
And then, we go through this whole process. But the other thing I was going to say is before you even go to court, you have to show the court that there's a reasonable assumption that code was stolen. Otherwise, anyone could go to court and say, hey, that guy stole my code, that company stole it. You'd waste a lot of court time and money and resources.
Exactly. Right.
So we actually have a tool that will compare the binaries. In other words, the actual code, not the source code, but the ones and zeros that's actually running on the computer. And we may not, our tool may not find anything. But if it finds something, it's a certain sign that something was copied, almost certain that something was copied. And we've had cases where, for example, one company had their development done in China.
Right.
And found that the Chinese company was selling almost the exact product on their website.
Well, and the Chinese have different standards, I guess.
Well, China's an issue. It's a big issue. But, you know, the company in China, the client of ours never got source code. They just got the final product.
Okay.
Said, well, we can't compare source code because we don't even have it, and we can't force a company in China to turn over source code. That's really difficult to go to another company, another country,
right,
and force the discovery of source code. So I said, well, you know, we can compare your binaries, download their program, mm-hmm. and compare it to your program, and we found things like error messages. There might have even been a spelling mistake in one of the error messages that was identical. And we actually found our client's company name buried in the binaries from the Chinese company.
No kidding.
Yeah.
You
know, it's not the first time we've found that. You know, you think that people who copy code are really smart and devious. And a lot of times sometimes they're just not thinking about it. Sometimes they just think they'll never get caught, so why bother spending a lot of time disguising the code?
Right. No, it's very important to take those precautionary measures and also use a tool such as your company's application to do the comparison and find out if there's a discrepancy. If there is a discrepancy, obviously you come out with a report, which I think is given to the client. The client can go to an attorney, to a legal practitioner, and say, here it is, here's my evidence. And then the attorney, for example, my office, would file the proper documents with the court to basically have a hearing and go before the judge to explain the situation and try to prove the case and obtain damages, maybe obtain temporary restraining orders, injunctions, which basically are orders from the court to the other side telling them to do or not to do something. All that being said, it's a pretty time-consuming process, but for certain reasons, obviously financial reasons being one of them, it's worthwhile, wouldn't you think?
Yeah. And, you know, I'm sure you try to keep costs down, and we try to keep costs down. You know, but the parties bringing the case, you know, the plaintiffs have to understand, and the defendants, you know, if they want to clear their name,
right,
they understand that this will run into money. But I think it's worthwhile. You know, you need to talk to the lawyers and the experts ahead of time. Let them know what your budgets are. This is my feeling. You know, sometimes we get a green light, and you know, from companies that say, "Do what you must," mm-hmm. and you know, no holds barred, because this is really important. And sometimes it is. We've been involved in cases that were worth up to $1 billion.
Mm-hmm.
But some companies say, "Okay, this is worth $100 million." So you know, if we spend $100,000, that's okay.
Mm-hmm.
But other companies kind of don't think about it until they get the bills and say, wait a minute, why did this cost so much? We try to keep them informed, but sometimes they just don't think about it. And, you know, you've obviously got, like anything else in business, you've got to do a cost-benefit analysis. But the benefits, you know, the risks of a competitor stealing your code, or the risks of getting accused of stealing when you haven't,
mm-hmm.
You know, your business can be, you know, that can put your business under, you know, a bad verdict.
Absolutely.
You should take costs into account, discuss your budgets up front, but I think you should be willing to spend what it's worth to keep your business alive.
I can't agree with you more. Some of the cases that we've handled in the past had to do with patent trolls, IP trolls. And I've ran into some cases like that. I've handled those, settled some of them, most of them actually. But what do you think about the non-practicing entities, which are also called the patent trolls?
So I have some strong opinions about that. And let me see if I can summarize them.
Let's first explain what patent trolls are. Maybe the listeners don't know about it. So let's just break it up and define it, if you don't mind.
Sure, sure. Well, that's a good point. Actually, part of the problem is that they're not well-defined. Some patent trolls are companies that buy up patents either from individual inventors or from companies that have gone bankrupt, and then they start asserting them against other companies. Mm-hmm. So that's one kind of patent troll. Some of them are very big, multi-billion-dollar companies. They collect big license fees. If they go to Microsoft or Apple or somebody like that and they say, pay us for our patents, the companies will never do that, so they go to court. And then, they may win a lot of money at court, they may lose, but you hear about the big verdicts where they win a lot of money. There's also universities are actually a type of patent troll, although people don't like to talk about that, because universities don't produce anything. Patent trolls are generally companies that don't produce anything. Mm-hmm. So universities do a lot of research, and they have a lot of patents, and they actually license them. Stanford does that a lot, one of my alma maters, and Cornell had a huge case against a company, won a big case against a company. People don't like to think of them as patent trolls, but they fit the definition. And then there's also a more recent phenomenon of companies that send letters. Let's say they claim to have a patent on the fax machine.
Right.
So every company that uses a fax machine, they send a letter saying, pay us $500 for the use of a fax machine.
Right.
So those kind of patent trolls, I think, are a problem. They're nuisances, the last kind. But I think there's an easy solution. Now, you can correct me if you see anything wrong with this, but this is what I've proposed. Because as a business person, I see this not only with patents, but with other things, too. Mm-hmm. I get letters once in a while from an attorney saying I owe money for something. A product I promised to buy, or who knows what. And my solution is to ignore them, because for $500, nobody is going to sue me to pay $500. They're hoping that some small percentage of people will just be so scared they'll put a check for $500 in the mail.
It's true. It's true. Somewhat, yes. You're right about that. But obviously,
so I mean, that's my solution. The other patent trolls, I think there are bad players and good players. But I think that's true of anything. And I'll just tell you one side of the patent trolls that people don't see. I had some software that I sold to a big company for years. I packaged it, and they bought a bunch of copies of the software for 7 years. Mm-hmm. And after 7 years, they wanted to buy the software and the patents from me. And I was happy to sell it to them. And we reached an agreement on a handshake and a term sheet. And they gave me a contract that had different terms in it. And I went to them and I said, well, this is probably a mistake because this isn't what we agreed to. Mm-hmm. And they said, no, we decided to change the terms. And I said, well, I've decided not to sell. So they came to me 3 months later. They desperately needed this software. And they came to me 3 months later. We did another negotiation. Again, they were coming to me, and they were my only customer at the time. And they said, okay, we entered into another negotiation. The same thing happened. And I said, I'm not going to sell, under these terms. So they actually said to me, well, we're going to create our own product. And I said, I have a patent, so you can't do that. They said, well, we don't think your patent's any good. We're going to do it anyway. So I went to a law firm who said that, I'd have to put down a deposit of $100,000, mm-hmm. therefore the court cost to be anywhere from $500,000 to $1 million.
Right.
If I wanted to sue this big company, because they came up with a product that they copied my product and stopped buying my product from me. And basically, it was going to be too expensive to proceed. But I approached a patent troll, and I said, do you want to buy my patents? And they said, yeah, and they bought my patents for a pretty good amount of money. Mm-hmm. And I assume they went after the company that was infringing my ex-customer and said, pay up. Now, I don't know, because that's private information, but for me,
right.
They rescued me because this big company had decided they were going to copy everything. After 7 years, they knew exactly how my software worked, and I had explained it to them many times, so they just copied it. So I think that's a side of patent trolls that people don't see.
Right. There are pros and cons, obviously, with patent trolls, like you said. And in your case, it came handy to be able to defer and delegate that task to them. But mostly, they're basically nuisance, and they contact people, like you said, for very small amounts of money, saying you're infringing upon so-and-so trademark or copyright or patent. We own it, or we have the license, and here, pay us X amount of dollars or else. Or in fact, sometimes they've actually filed a lawsuit, usually in federal court, and yeah. They have a list of people that they need to contact, so they somehow get them served, the summons and complaint. And then the defendant comes to an attorney and tries to, figure out what defensive claims they can bring and whether or not it's something they can settle. And usually we settle these cases for very small amounts of money. And there is a technique and there is a strategy that my law firm uses. There is no guarantee for that dollar amount, but we usually settle them for pretty much a portion of what the plaintiff is asking for.
And I think that's why people need to talk to attorneys. May seem obvious, but what I do is whenever I get something in the mail or somebody's threatening something, or I'm even in a situation where, or I've tried to negotiate with someone, a company about something, I always talk to an attorney because I want to know what's the best strategy and also what's legal. You can run into the problem where you start doing things. I know this in particular employment law, which is not your area, but I've had experience with employment law where you think I'm the head of the company, I can just do X, Y, and Z.
Right.
And then you find out later that the law says you can't do that.
That's right.
So it's always good to have someone with your kind of experience, reviewing the actions that you plan to take and giving you advice on strategy and not just the law, but strategy.
That's why we're here, and we're, here for the audience to call us, to email us. We're all out of time right now. I wanted to thank you again for having, being on the show with us. Again, folks, this is the Legal Help Desk. My name is Salar Atrazadeh, and my guest today was Bob Zeidman from Zeidman Consulting. You can find him on the Internet. His website is ZeidmanConsulting.com. He's an expert in patents and trademark and software forensics. If you have any questions, you can also call my office at 310-694-3034. Bob, thank you again for being here today with us, and I wish you happy holidays.
Thank you, Salar. You too. It was my pleasure.
Okay. Take care.
Bye.